Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, Paisan?
Doing great.
Joined, as always, by super producer Matt Leck. Going dolo. What do we have for the brand F-up of the week?
The brand F-up this week comes from Harvard University. It's not actually the university itself. It's just a
It could be, but
we're gonna lay off Harvard because they're actually pretty swift in their actions as it pertains to this particular brand F-up. Apparently, a group of incoming freshmen, at least 10 of them, had their admissions offers revoked from the university as a result of sharing offensive material in what they thought was a private Facebook group. These group of teens joined the Harvard College Class of 2021 Facebook group, which is a official group.
Right.
Then they decided to break off into their own group, which has an amazing name. I thought, anyway.
Yeah, which is...
Harvard Memes for Horny Bourgeois Teens.
That's not bad. That's a good name.
Not bad, former Harvard class of 2021. As this group was used to share racist, misogynist, you know, the usual type of things that you would want incoming freshmen to be sharing among themselves in a group called, and I lost it again, you know, Harvard Memes for Horny Bourgeois Teens.
That's a great name, though. If they left it at the name, I would say not only get a pass, I'd give them props. That's more clever than I'd expect from incoming Harvard kids. SAT prep is not good for your wit.
No.
And neither is having a trust fund, usually. But, no, I mean, you know, so, I mean, do we have examples of some of these dastardly memes?
They said there were quite a few of them that were just pretty racy about the Holocaust and, you know, all the topics that you don't really want to be discussing that just aren't funny, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm of mixed minds about this. I mean, on one hand, I think it's very healthy that as a culture, and I think anybody could have told you who had any time around any type of elite college institution at any point, that the image of these places as like sort of, you know, bastions of regal intellects was always totally delusional. And, you know, prep school humor and elite humor has always had a lot of racism, sexism, you know, and sort of lameness to it. So I think it's good that this stuff is exposed on a cultural level. On the other hand, here's one. This is a rabbi. It says, why don't Jews eat pussy? Because it's too close to the gas chamber. Yeah, like that's not funny. It's because it's a dumb fart joke, Matt. It's disgusting. It's stupid. It's a really bad joke.
Yeah.
That actually, so for me, as soon as I look at that, that's my kind of like, if you say that joke, I don't want you around me. Not because it's a Holocaust joke, but because it's just that joke. It's uncomfortably lame. And, you know, on the other hand, I mean, I do think that this is one of those, like, this is something that is very specific to our time. And I'll be really clear, I won't do false humility. I never said anything like that when I was that age, and I never had such a bad sense of humor. But I always did have a questionable sense of humor, and I certainly would not want everything that I have ever had on my social media or anything that I've ever, you know, said to sort of catch me. So look, you know, incoming Harvard students, they're not the most, you know, vulnerable people in the world, obviously, but there is a part of me that's like, okay, you know, 17-year-old doing something stupid on Facebook and losing a big opportunity. That's at least something that we should register about our time. And I think, you know, I always like to do the pushback because the answer is always like, well, you know, now you just need to know that everything you do is going to be publicly recorded and, you know, that's on you. And I don't really believe that. I think we need to kind of think of different, you know, mechanisms for how these things are governed. But, you know, at the same time, wow, that was a fucking...
Yeah.
That joke, you know, all this in the abstract makes me more sympathetic to these kids. But after reading that meme, just brand-wise, Harvard can't have them there. It's fucking lame.
They can't do it. And I guess it does open up a potentially bigger conversation in the sense that, yeah, you do have to have a certain sense of awareness that you're going into this university. There is no such thing as a private Facebook group or a private chat, group chat. Like, at some point, that stuff is leaving a record. And that record is going to follow you as it's followed these kids and cost them an incredible opportunity. Like, we can sit and make jokes about Harvard and what that is, but the meaningfulness of getting into that university is fairly significant to your life's potential trajectory.
Right.
You know, and it's a high price to pay for some shit that A, wasn't really that funny in the first place and was just dumb and in poor taste, you know. I don't feel any particular sympathy for them. I think, yeah, you got to set some sort of standard, and Harvard chose to set this one, because at some point I don't view Harvard as some, you know, university or some institution that's particularly concerned in the abstract about these things, but for themselves, they want to protect themselves.
Yeah, you know, so these getting, kids, these yeah, getting kids knowledge engaged of this, in a brand F up,
yeah.
and the university needs to protect themselves from a brand F up, and that's what it is. We got to get to what's up. Hey, guys, do you know why Jewish people don't eat pussy? Oh, shit, I'm fucked. We on mic? All right, so now we got to get to what's up, and there's a new story that's coming from Silicon Valley and kind of implicates the roles of billionaires, public education, and public policy, which is a theme we're interested in. Mark Benioff, who's the creator of Salesforce.com, and a guy who, you know, I'll say, not to be like PC before we criticize him, is definitely in his very successful record in business. He's funded some interesting things and been involved in like the Wisdom 2.0 conference. It's emerged that he's going to put $100 million over the course of a decade into San Francisco Unified School District through his company's nonprofit arm, Salesforce.org. And this is quoting out from the New York Times, unlike conventional benefactors, he's hands-on. School district administrators now submit an annual grant list to Salesforce.org board review, and Mr. Benioff dispenses not just money, but also management prescriptions. Several years ago, when Cory Booker was still mayor of Newark, Mark Zuckerberg put significant amount of money into Newark public schools. The results have definitely been mixed at best, and there were some interesting innovations and ideas with tech and individualized approaches, but a lot of very rightful pushback from communities, not to mention educators, who seem to never really be taken seriously in these articles. And Sarah Jones in the New Republic, who's a very good journalist, she kind of points out that there's a bigger cultural problem just in the kind of assumption that just because you make money or just because you run a business well means you understand education. So the analogy I always use is that, you know, the New Jersey public school teacher of the year is never going to get brought in to help, you know, turn around a problem at Salesforce.com or at Facebook or at Instagram. You know, this cultural valorization of the CEO. And Sarah Jones kind of basically says, look, I mean, if you want to help public education, then advocate that you pay significantly higher taxes. And I would add that you de-link property taxes from public school education, because that's one of the reasons why there's such fundamental structural inequality in schools. But I think this is an important space for us, both from the kind of cultural questions we ask and also that the themes of should education be updated and modernized and more individualized is a separate question from should it just become a sort of space for corporate CEOs to play. Innovation does not have to just be the kind of handmaiden of a certain type of tech takeover. So I'm skeptical of it because of the kind of cultural context around it. It seems a little skimpy on the other hand. I mean, you know, he's throwing $100 million into the schools and, you know, okay, cool. But I'm wary.
Yeah, wary is a good place to put it. You got to start anytime people are giving large amounts of money to something, despite the fact that, you know, we think about these things garnering goodwill, there's definitely an agenda as to the why they're doing it. The Zuckerberg example is a good one. You know, the Bill Gates Foundation is another one. He has put a lot of money into not only education here in the United States, but also abroad, and many other philanthropic causes, particularly as it pertains to health sciences and health services in the developing parts of the world. And that's, you know, I'll flippantly say it's all well and good, but in reality, it's really not. Like, I think these, you know, we're substituting private investment and philanthropy with its own sort of social and political agendas for a lack of public infrastructure and focus toward investing in these areas. And so charity in all its form, whether it's institutional charity through grant writing or wealthy individuals, basically can make up the slack from a lack of public investment in these spaces. And that's deeply problematic as to what sort of society that we want to build. You know, do you turn away the $100 million if it can do some tangential good? I don't know if I'd go that far, but I think we have to start to imagine what type of society we want to build. And it's unfortunate that particularly with this political environment, we are very unable to do that. We're in this constant state of, you know, what, you know, me and my crew used to call the cow in the tornado. You know, if those who remember Twister, you're just sort of constantly spinning. And it doesn't, when you're in that sort of mode, it doesn't lend itself to be an environment where you can kind of think forward in a constructive way and ask the harder questions. And education is one of those things that unfortunately falls heavily into that category, particularly when it's public education in our larger cities.
I also just, I think that it's really worth examining from a longer term business perspective. There's an ideological fanaticism in the United States that says that business can solve all problems, which is obviously not the case. We can look at, you know, everything from failed experiments in privatizing education to, you know, deregulating Wall Street as to why that doesn't work. But I think that where's the desire among people working in business space or tech space to really do what it is that they do without this sort of, you know, fantasy? Because I think one of the reasons that there's such a backlash now against Silicon Valley, as an example, and all of the cliches from, you know, the TED Talk culture, is because of the kind of massive oversell in terms of both the benefits of all of these practices, because some of these things in terms of the new tech economy are obviously incredibly disruptive, or there are things like we talked about second, you know, the hustle and side gigs, which are like really just simply kind of like band-aids on bigger problems facing society. You know, that's one thing. And then the other thing is just that a lot of these tools have just been oversold. You know, of course, technology is completely, you know, there are areas like just even in doing what we're doing, which completely are due to revolutions in technology, which is a product of government investment and private innovation, and they've transformed all of our lives fundamentally. But I also, you know, putting an iPad in a school does not make the education better. You know, disrupting given sector does not necessarily mean it produces better results. And I think that, you know, the cliche cultures of these businesses are going to, you know, are hurting them with their consumers and their fields. And partially there could be a dial back of that if there was just a lot more humility and sense of proportion and intelligence about saying, you know, what you do. You know, Salesforce.com does, you know, tech support. It helps facilitate things. It, you know, it produces a lot of money and helps people have a lot of results. That's what they do. I don't know what Mark Benioff knows about education. And I agree with Sarah Jones. If he wants to help it, he should be out, you know, advocating for a good, strong, progressive, social democratic program so we can have well-rounded, educated people that can help make his company better and build a better civil society. And if business starts to kind of move out of that place of cliche and that place of imperialism, they'll start to rebuild some trust with the public.
Yeah, technology is not a panacea. Got to look beyond that. Does not solve all questions. And most of the times, it doesn't even ask the right ones. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's another big part of it. You know, they can only, you know, solve problems through their particular lens, you know, and if you only have a hammer, then everything looks like a nail.
If you only have an app, then everything looks like the app store.
Yeah.
And that's what's up. We got to get to what's next.
Now we want to jump to what's next. And we've talked a lot about retail, the future of retail, what that means as it continues to fail. And we're going to look at retail from a different perspective. And I'm laughing as I tell this story because fidget spinners, it's a ridiculous name.
But, it's ridiculous.
But I'm sure anyone listening to this has at least seen a fidget spinner, particularly if they have anyone in their life under 10 years old, maybe even under 12. You've definitely seen these toys. For those who are not familiar, they are a very small three-pronged item that is meant to spin on a finger of your choosing. Some of them light up, some of them don't, and they come in slightly different shapes, but you got to get the sense of it. Picture a four-leaf clover of sort of something like that that also spins if you're kind of looking for the shape of them. And I was overseas very recently, and it really came into my mind because even in Italy, these things are everywhere. So I left the United States seeing them in parks and kind of being spread around, being sold in the usual places you see people selling like bootleg stuff. And then boom, I'm overseas and they're just as prevalent.
Yeah.
So that got me thinking, like, how the fuck did they do that? You know, like it's rare to see something like that that's just, you know,
yeah, they flipped the supply chain.
Yeah, they flipped the supply chain. And there's an interesting read in BuzzFeed News that goes through a very specific how Chinese manufacturers were able to basically flood the market and basically bypass all the traditional outlets in which you would think you would get an item like this, meaning major retailers and online sellers like Amazon and Alibaba and so on and so forth. And now they're everywhere. And I think what makes this interesting is that you have to look at how this sort of mass production and direct manufacturer to consumer model is going to, again, really impact retail as you go forward. If a major brand like a Mattel that is a huge toy maker or a Hasbro, if they're too slow to get in on things like this, their supply chain cannot possibly keep up with thousands of bootleggers just making a quick, cheap plastic toy that's probably going to break in 2 months or be discarded as quickly. You know, how do they compete? How do they keep up in these like kind of very small analog markets that are very, like I said, manufacturer to consumer almost?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this obviously it's on one hand, it's fun to watch the kind of, you know, incumbent players get outmaneuvered like this. But at the same time, like, you know, and this is an example of why we have those kind of tight mechanisms in place, is so that the market isn't flooded with, you know, defective or dangerous products.
Filled with lead.
You know, filled with lead, which is another recent story that has come about this, you know, out of the, as they call it, the great fidget spinner frenzy of 2017. But this is, you know, this is a broader, you know, kind of theme. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways his argument's overstated, but, you know, Parag Khanna, his new book, Connectography, says that really that one of the kind of main power sort of competitions of the 21st century is access to supply chains and where you fit in the supply chain and, you know, how kind of quickly you can fit into it is a major determiner of where you will be, you know, financially and power wise. And obviously this kind of story and this sort of product and phenomenon speaks perfectly to two of the kind of really cliche areas of the new economy, but nonetheless important ones. And that's, you know, online retail, direct to consumer. And I should add a third, which is just China.
Yeah.
You know, this notion of just kind of a place of limitless, fast, basically a hybrid of full government control with essentially no regulation and, you know, incredibly fast production.
Yeah, China's the catch-all. You know, when in doubt, talk about China or millennials, right? Like,
yes.
That's sort of the, you know, branding 101 nowadays. But beyond that point, what this really reminded me of was Pokemon Go of about a year ago. This, you know, the online game that had this viral element to it that was captivating everybody, you know, and it did obviously die down, as all these things eventually do, but it's the way in which this has a, not so much the digital presence, but it has this analog presence that we talk about a lot, that it's something that's shared, you know, largely among kids. They trade them among themselves, and they're everywhere you look. And that supply chain argument is perfectly positioned for the spread of these sort of viral things that just kind of pop up, you know, whether it's the fidget spinner most recently, the hoverboards that were blowing up literally.
Yeah. Well, that's another story of the Chinese supply chain outwitting U.S. regulators.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You can't keep up with that sort of speed. Also, when coupled with a don't give a fuckness of making sure that shit doesn't explode.
I mean, yeah. No, and then yeah, that you touched on that other part too, which is it is interesting to watch. You know, I think we can draw an analogy. We're talking with Rob Fields about, in the entertainment realm, the resurgence of game shows and the kind of desire for simplicity and entertainment. And then, you know, the Pokemon Go connection that you just drew, which for all of the tech of it was in some, you know, it's a scavenger hunt. I mean, that's a pretty, you know, old school game, just enabled by some new technology. And then, you know, and now we've got the fidget spinner. It does. I mean, it's, you know, in some ways we're more romantic and high level when we talk about analog culture. We're talking about records versus what's in your phone. But this is analog culture too. And the idea that, you know, people are still going to have an appetite for very simple and very basic things. And this is obviously an area where you can be a really, really effective predator, yeah, if you're thinking clearly.
You can't get more basic than this.
You cannot get more basic than this.
Fidget spinners are basically tops that spin on your fingers.
And that's what's next.
And Matt wants one. And that's what's next. All right. So now we got to get into the crates. Been meaning to read this for a while. Actually, one of my undergraduate professors at Bates was a C.L.R. James scholar. So I did read some C.L.R. James with him. But I've started and I'm embarking upon Black Jacobins, which is a 1938 book by a prominent Trinidadian Marxist and sports writer, C.L.R. James, on the Haitian Revolution and the relationship between the Haitian Revolution and the French Revolution. And it also goes into the Caribbean economy, European feudalism, and really, you know, I would say in this sort of time of all of these debates, many of which I think are very false and very foolish debates, kind of pitting radical adjustment of economic realities with, you know, the enduring legacies of things like imperialism, colonialism, and racism. You know, C.L.R. James is pretty indispensable for figuring that type of thing out. And I think it's also just a broader work of cultural insight or fluency. So Black Jacobin, CLR James, get on it. That's my crates for the week.
I also have a book. I read this about a year ago, maybe a little bit more. And it's called Lawrence in Arabia. The subtitle is War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. It's by Scott Anderson. And, you know, given our always tumultuous time, and even with very recent news in the Middle East, just over these past couple of days with Qatar and what's going on there, I think these books, a book like this, gives actually a really good, well, it's written very well. That's one of the first things that's very important when you're kind of reading dense historical novels. Not all of them are created equal in terms of their readability, despite the information that exists within them. This reads actually really well, and through the lens of, you know, what's the person popularly known as Lawrence of Arabia, a British officer in World War I, you get a really good sense of how the colonialism of the time and World War I really did help shape what we think of as the Middle East. And if there's ever a case for blowback, this is probably some of the original meaning of that word in intelligence, where people were making decisions and doing things without any real understanding of how it would affect history, and in particular our current time. So it's a great read, and again, it's called Lawrence in Arabia: War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East by Scott Anderson.
That's another journey. Thank you, brother. Thank you, super producer Matt Leck. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Instagram at @2DopeBoysPod, @FarflungPhil, @_MichaelBrooks, @MattLeck. See you on Thursday for On Point.